Hello.
Hello, how are you today?
I'm good.
Welcome to the Wandering Tech Podcast, episode...
Episode 18.
This whole professional thing is not working. Okay, let me try that again. So welcome to the Wandering Tech Podcast, episode 18. I am your co-host, Lydia, and I am joined by, and always joined by, my co-host, Paul. Hello.
Hello.
This is strange. We haven't done that before.
We didn't actually discuss how that's going to happen. So, but we'll get there. We'll work on it. I can say you're the... No, it's the thing of it's like, I'm this person and I'm this person. And I'm like, maybe, although it would probably get confusing because I can go, you're Lydia, and be like, you're Paul. But then I probably end up saying, I'm Lydia. Which...
the hair colour is wrong, but otherwise, pretty spot on.
I need to grow my hair back out.
Yeah, no, it's easy to confuse, right? I wonder how our listeners are able to differentiate between the two of us. It's the accent.
It has
to be the accent. Yeah, but we are trying to as always, and this is going to be most likely an ongoing process for maybe, you know, in my optimistic calculations, going to be about 10, 15 more episodes of us figuring out exactly how we want to run this thing. I think in the beginning we were speaking about like how we don't want a lot of structure, we want it to be a little bit more free-falling, but the reality of the world is that it's easier for us, it's easier for the listeners to have a little bit more structure around what we're doing, so we're going to be implementing that a little bit more. So in the initial section of the podcast, obviously, like we will continue to doing this, and you know, whenever there's updates, whenever there's feedback, whenever we want to, you know, just do something right at the start, we're going to be doing it as expected right at the start before we dive into the meat and potatoes section of the episodes. So do give us our feedback on how you think things are going. Efforts, you know, obviously I keep on asking folks for feedback, and some are so gracious to actually give it to me. So we are going to do our best to keep on implementing that as time goes.
Yeah, I think it's funny, and we acknowledged this yesterday when we were talking about how we're going to update the structure, that the problem we both have is that we are like the podcast listener equivalent of a super user, in that I know for me, I always have something on. Like, I occasionally listen to music, but 90% of the time I'm listening to a podcast, which means I get through a lot and I quite like long, kind of rambly ones. But as you say, what we found, and it's great that people who don't maybe listen to as many listen to us, which is amazing. But if you have like a 20-minute commute either way in your day and that's your slot, it's a bit much. And I think it's, as we go, we'll sort of figure out where we get to. Fear not, AI therapy is staying, and we have a doozy today as well. But before we get to that, I think we should sort of, this is going to be really weird, and I'm going to be open about it. It's kind of weird because we have said we need to be more structured, which means we have to jump. I don't want it to be like weird sort of right left turns, but I kind of feel like there might be a few of those, or just more interstitial.
Yep. Whoosh! Q whooshing. I actually brought to you, Paul, a couple of articles today that I want to talk you through. One is more generally technical, the other one is more within the pre-sale space. I don't know if you had the chance to actually look at them in the show notes, but I will take everyone through like the little journey that I had as I was reading them through. The first one is coming straight from the Register, and it's about a topic that's very dear to my heart, which is what's happening in VMware land, which for folks that are not familiar, was the company that I used to work with. I think it's one of those companies that a lot of people are vaguely familiar with, but are not really that invested in, because it's not one of the, especially post-acquisition, it's not one of the really big ones. But I wanted to highlight it as a very strange behavior for leaders of such technology companies, but also the direction in which they're talking about, which is, as we're going through it, Paul, you will recognize it's a topic that I'm quite passionate about, which is bring back workloads on premises, down with the clouds. Which, by the way, I've never actually asked you, like, we've had vague conversations on the topic, obviously, especially within the context of the company that you work for right now, which is like, you know, again, vague conversations on the topic. Yeah. But where do you stand on that quite controversial topic of should we be going back to oldie days of 3-4 years ago of having our own on-premises data centers and keeping everything in-house and having our own teams internally to do that? Or should we just offload everything to people who know better? I'm using sarcasm there, folks.
I know. And I'm going to give a great pre-sales answer, which depends. It really depends. So my part of my brain that comes from, and for folks that don't know, I started my career networking and IT infrastructure, which was in spent time, we've talked about server rooms before, but spending time plugging cables in and identifying what cable goes where on the switch. And I will be honest, that is not a world that I miss, sitting in a dark room with a little label printer, printing out numbers to put onto cables so that when you... Essentially, if you're in a, imagine you're in an office building and you have all the little outputs for all your cables and you need to have numbers on all of them because you need to know back in the server room what connections on the switch and the router, what goes where, because you need to know, oh, I'm connecting this part of the network to this part. And I need to know if I'm...
Yeah, you need to be able to trace, you need to be able to trace your way around,
exactly.
Practically.
And if you're moving computers around an office, you need to be able to know what you're working. There's a whole like industry built around being able to, particularly in large scale private data centers, in being able to manage those. Now, the thing that the big downside to that are from a business is it's a very, very high cost. There's a lot of investment. You also can make a case that it's not very sustainable because it's very high energy.
It's a lot of upfront investment, and there's also a lot of ongoing.
And it requires a lot of energy, actual just electricity to run, not just the infrastructure itself, but the cooling. And unless you are big enough that you can source your own renewable energy, you're potentially creating. And it's the issue that we hear a lot again around AI. But which is the incredible amount of energy consumption. And I think that's where I go. When I say it depends, I think there is absolutely space for cloud computing insofar as it lowers the point of entry for a lot of companies because you do not have that same upfront and ongoing cost. And that's the same for a vendor because you can design and you can scale your product much more easily if it's in the cloud. However, there are industries for which either the cloud becomes a bigger challenge, or quite honestly, almost an impossibility. But again, that is dependent upon the use case. And you can have the extreme example that most people come to is when you're talking in sort of aerospace and defense. And that's not always a security thing, that's just an infrastructure issue. It's not that you don't have, that your product isn't stable in cloud, right? It's just that the physical infrastructure, the connectivity infrastructure doesn't exist to those locations. They're so, because of how remote they are. So that's one sort of side of it.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's also a lot more scope, though, for edge technology in this, which isn't something we've talked about before, I don't think.
No, we haven't. But, and by the way, just for reference and for folks that haven't been incredibly nerding into this space like you and I have, the idea of a cloud is practically, it's someone else's data center, right? So that's the simplest explanation that I can have. And a data center is a place that you're hosting data applications, etc. Whatever it is that your technology business is providing, you know, in any level, shape or form of software, there will be a data center somewhere to provide that. It's either in-house, is going to be, as we were discussing, is going to be hosted somewhere on someone else's data center, aka cloud.
Yeah.
And by the way, to your point, and I like that you mentioned that, it's like, you know, it is a size thing about people who are able to claim that they are having a, I would say like a carbon, you know, not negative, but an okay from an environmental perspective. It's only big companies. The only one I can think of is a data center built actually very close by to where my parents live from Meta. So it's that size of that type of size of companies that we're referring to here. So it's not going to be your run of the mill, you know, ordinary software provider that's going to be able to have the resources to do that. So environmental impact is definitely going to be a huge aspect of having those conversations. And you can have make the argument that folks like, you know, public cloud providers like AWS, like Google, like Oracle, like they will be able to deal with that better, allegedly. And some of them, and I think not some of them, all of them have some sort of pledge in that and in that direction. But I think you're right, and yes, whilst it is the favorite pre-sales answer to say it depends, the reality is that, especially having been at VMware, who seemingly, especially when I joined, seemed to be a company that was not sure about where they belong, it was quite a lot of ping-ponging between like, oh no, we are non-premises, because that was obviously where they came, like that's the, you know, their climb to fame, and you know how they had like such a huge market share was the fact that like, yeah, we will take care of on-premises. But obviously when public cloud became such a huge thing, it was like, oh no, but we need to, you know, obviously we need to get into that game as well. So it was this really strange ping-ponging sort of like the last couple of years before the acquisition about like, where do we belong, right? So like, are we talking public cloud, are we talking on-premises, like are we talking about connecting the two, or like how do you, right? So it was a big like sort of identity crisis that I think the company was having at the time. So it's quite funny to see that yet again, there actually are ping-ponging them back now to on-premises as a lot of the challenges with public cloud are sort of coming to fruition, which is, yeah, now that they have so many people actually utilizing these resources, you know, and when I say they, I do mean like you know, public cloud providers, they suddenly realize like, oh, actually, it's quite expensive to maintain and run this. We need to crank up the prices. And suddenly something that used to be a cheaper option, because one, you're not paying an in-house team. Two, you're not paying all of the cooling, the electricity costs, you know, everything that you were mentioning there, Paul. Suddenly, they cranked up the prices on that. It was like, oh no, actually, this is not great. And there comes also the rest of the issues that come along with like having to have a outside of your domain of control from an engineering perspective. How do you maintain and curate and have the expertise? Because you still need the expertise to be able to maintain these externally hosted resources in one way or another. And we're still, and again, it's still quite an early, I would say, direction of technology. Like the host of engineers out there are not there yet in comparison to the slew of people that you have from a purely skill perspective that know how to do on-premises infrastructure, but are, you know, might have taken a step into how do you do, you know, off-site hosted infrastructure. And most people have, because right, you know, a lot of the underlying technology is still the same. It's just another person's, it's the same. It's another person's on-premises, but there are still some intricacies and complexities that people need to learn, and the people are simply not there. So that's also another issue with public cloud. So my personal stance on this is similar to yours, right? And it's the pre-sales answer, which is, yeah, it depends. I am much more in favor of control. I'm a little bit more traditionalist in that sense of I am seeing a lot more benefits of having everything in-house than moving things away. It makes sense to move things away when you have important thing for that set of applications or data is to be easily accessible from anywhere, because that's something that, you know, you as a business would really struggle to do, because that means you need to potentially, and when it comes to like data sovereignty, right? Like if you're in the UK, you need to have a presence in the UK to host sets of data. If you're in the EU, you need to have a presence in the EU to do that. If you're in the US, same in the US, right? So every country or every region will have its own requirements. That is a problem that public cloud solves amazingly well. And if I had to like rank like use cases for public cloud, that is top use case right there. Secondly would be, as you were saying about barrier to entry. Like if you and I, let's say, like we sit down and go like, hey, you know, it'd be really cool if we set up like a software service. Our first step would be, okay, let's spin up like an AWS instance and like set it up there so people can access it. Like we're not gonna, you and I, Paul, are not gonna be buying servers, right? We're not buying infrastructure. Like I am not buying an air conditioning unit just for the sake of like not burning my house down to be able to be hosting this on premises, quote unquote, my house. Yeah. So it's absolutely not happening. But like to my point about ping ponging back, if I can read out to you the quote that I actually took away from the Register's article there, which is, so speaking at a function during the VMware Explore conference yesterday, which by the way is VMware's like, you know, yearly or bi-yearly event that they talk about technology, like it's the same as like, you know, WWDC for Apple, like it's the big event, or Cisco Live for Cisco. Hock Tan, which is the Broadcom CEO, told the audience that the virtualization giant's mission is now taking workloads back from the public cloud, which is going incredibly against what the mission statement was pre-acquisition. So we were definitely more in, you know, buddy-buddy with public cloud providers. And there was a lot of services and everything else that we were sort of positioning to customers that had to do with working alongside with public cloud providers. As you can imagine, public cloud providers, not happy with this statement. And I love this quote because I think it speaks volumes to that, which is, I already am getting dirty emails from the hyperscalers, the CEO added. They say something like, hey, what are you telling them? What are you doing to us?
And I think that's important, right? Because this is clearly, and it's the subtext is there, right? But let's call it out. They clearly have a vested interest. There's going to be a, behind all of these things, there's going to be a reason why VMware are now pushing this up as opposed to what they were doing before. Because they're saying, hey, actually, we're now trying to pull back from the hype. And I think you kind of hit it on the head there, right? Is it's the ways that I would quantify is almost like it's about accessibility, scalability, and total cost of ownership. Because you're then, and that's kind of what it boils down to, and that's where the benefits of cloud are, right? That's what it is. It's that accessibility, it's the ability to scale, and it's the fact that it's a lot cheaper for vendors, for new, as you say, for us. If we were to start a software company tomorrow, our barrier of entry to make that product available to customers would be by hosting it on a hyperscaler, because that way that sort of piece is taken care of for it. And then for customers, it's like, oh, they just have one price to pay, and then in perpetuity they're going to, as long as they're paying for access to it, they continue to get the service. I think there's other kind of challenges, and there's other ways that sort of subscription model is getting used. I think we see this problem of very low price point to start. Oh, actually, hang on, we're not making any money. We now need to massively jack up the prices. It happens in every subscription, in every consumer subscription, right? You see it. And that's kind of what it comes back to. And so that's where I saw this, and I thought, it's funny because, again, clearly they've figured out, oh, hang on, we're not making as much money as we used to be. We now need to start pushing. And there is, again, I think it's a very industry specific thing, without getting into like in the weeds of this industry, that industry, whatever. Public cloud infrastructure as it is today is, and again, I was in IT when this was first like talked about, when like Azure Cloud was first launched, when Office 365 was first launched, and it was a terrible, terrible product when it first launched. It was in no way ready to use. But I already use things like Dropbox and Google Drive. So I already kind of use public cloud services at that time. And you see where that's kind of come in the last 10 years, and it's like, oh, now much more mature. And
And by the way, Paul, I just wanted to put in the differentiation between public cloud services and public cloud infrastructure.
Okay. Yeah.
Because I do believe, so the only reason I'm calling the difference out there is because, yes, one, there is a maturity when it comes to public cloud services. Mm-hmm. So practically what Microsoft are doing with like Office 365 is practically what other companies were given the opportunity to do when hyperscalers started offering infrastructure as a service.
Yeah.
So that is practically what happened. So there is a level of maturity between those two sort of subsets of technology, mm-hmm. where absolutely at this point, and very much like agreeing with you, like in the beginning, it was a rocky road. First of all, to get people on board, because like why would I have somewhere like a publicly hosted web like server.
Yeah.
Right, that was even like those were the conversations I was having in my first role, because like we have a we have a web server at home.
Yeah.
Like, why would we pay Microsoft to like host this stuff for us? Whilst nowadays it's complete, like this is the norm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, and it's a quite a quick turnaround. But infrastructure as a service, first of all, I do think it's still very early days, but also something happened there where either incredibly talented salespeople or just positioning in such a, or people having seen the success they had with services offerings, mm. they saw infrastructure in the same way and went like, oh, obviously, like, yeah, Office 365 was such a good idea, and it was such a good implementation once they obviously like worked out the kinks, that yeah, we're gonna go full on into cloud, because that's the way to do it. And that's really the crux of the matter, where suddenly it's like, oh, we're gonna shove everything into cloud. Oh crap, what is this £7 million pounds bill that I got from AWS? Oh no.
Yeah, and I think I'm really glad you started talking there about infrastructure as a service. I think that's a really important distinction to draw for folks listening, because when the kind of the route that people go on is they go, they think cloud, they think SaaS, and kind of I guess it's kind of important at this point to say, look, we're not trying to say, I think SaaS, as we said, and actually that's what we've been saying all along, right? If we're launching a product, if you're launching a service, a software as a service does not have to be hosted on the cloud. That's not how you define SaaS. That's a separate thing. But providing web-based applications, is it, where you pay a annual subscription, monthly subscription to a vendor to get access to their software in the enterprise space, I think is something that, and that kind of comes back to what I said about the industries. Industry specific, that's where it kind of gets a bit more dicey. But broadly, right, broadly, that I think is here and is here to stay. And I think for all the reasons we've talked about. Infrastructure as a service, IaaS, that is the, and I think, yeah, moving, if I think going back to when I was in IT, at the time we had a lot of stuff still on premise. And that was because the person that I worked for who ran our IT was wedded to it, and he had come from a defense background and was like, no, everything has to be completely securely locked down. I left the business 8 years ago. I know from people that are still working there, they've now started to adopt a lot more cloud-based solution, right? So things like Office 365, cloud-based solution.
Yeah.
They do still have an internal infrastructure for things like, well, there's firstly, the nature of the business, it's a law firm, so the nature of the business is they have some software that just is not available in the cloud. There isn't a web-based
version. Yeah. Especially like legacy software that the entire business is practically operating on. It's a very similar thing in banking and finance as well, right? Like a lot of that infrastructure that they need. Incredibly niche, and like there is no, same as healthcare, by the way. Like healthcare had a very similar set of issues, because like these things have been running since the 90s and they still run. Why would we change?
Right, and the companies that are developing them, the business model operates fine on a perpetual license and a support model. They don't have an incentive to change.
Yep.
So that I think is true, and I think that it's like there's a difference between, and it's really important, I think, again, to drive this home, is like there's a difference between being a cloud first company in how you look at the software that you are using to run your business, and how you choose to run your own internal IT infrastructure, which is things like your telecommunication, your actual internal network, how you kind of collaborate internally, and what do you use internally? So what are the finance tools? What are the development tools you run? And I think it's about kind of saying, well, yeah. And again, I think we're probably kind of ending up more closer to maybe to in terms of agreement. It does depend. The it depends, I think, is more applicable to the software side. I think with the exception of small business, as we said, right, small businesses, startup, where you might use a 365, you might use a G Suite, an Oracle, that kind of thing, to not just be your emails and your etc., but also to be your entire file structure. For big organizations, I can see why you would not necessarily want to go wholly down because of cost. If you're, as you say.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense.
No, and by the way, Paul, like I maybe sound like, because I am definitely more of an on-premises kind of gal, but there are definite use cases for cloud infrastructure than just what I was mentioning earlier about, like, you know, startups and small businesses, etc. Whenever you have a burst of traffic coming through, right, like I always like use the example with universities, like when applications are coming through, when like, you know, thousands of students are logging in to check their results, like you don't have the flexibility in-house as a university to be able to sustain and not have things break down, or if you do, it's just a humongous investment for a very short period of time.
Yeah.
I think those are, like, again, it's specific use cases. So like when we say it depends, it really genuinely, it is a true answer there, because it's so use case specific that you can't have a blanket like, oh, everything is going to cloud. But also on the other end of the spectrum, to Hock Tan's opinion, also don't bring everything back in-house. Mm. Because there's definitely use cases for either or. I think it's like, and I kept on describing this to customers when I was still at VMware. So it's like a pendulum swing, right? So we went from having everything on premises to all the way to the other hand of, you know, oh, everything's going to cloud. And then we're going back again. And I think as time progresses, that's going to be even slower and slower and slower. And this sort of like sits in the middle where, again, for some things, yes, go cloud. For some things, yes, go stay on premises. But again, it's so use case specific. But speaking of that, by the way, and again, that push to like getting people back on premises, AT&T are suing Broadcom at the moment, which I thought, this is like after I found the article from the Register. This is like yesterday, I think I found the article that AT&T have actually launched a lawsuit against Broadcom for their unfriendly customer relationships, and practically the term they used was bullying tactics. And I'm just like, oh, not a great, you're not doing great there, Betty, for like, being a proponent of like what I believe in, which is, more on premises. But like, maybe this is not the way. Maybe bullying people into paying ridiculous money. Not
you
the
say
way.
AT&T suing Broadcom, and I just think Alien versus Predator, whoever wins, we lose. Talking about pre-sales, and I think we've acknowledged probably about halfway, maybe about like around episode 9 or 10, when we first started like talking about pre-sales, we suddenly realized, hey, we should maybe talk about the thing that we are in and that we're kind of in the sphere of, shall we say. We're kind of in the gravitational pull of what a pre-sale. There's an interesting article that you shared with me, and we should caveat, this was by Viven, who are, anyone in the pre-sale space is probably aware of who Viven are. For context, they're a software company who do sort of pre-sales management software is how I would probably describe. But they put a piece out, and you know, they kind of have been in the last sort of 3-4 years since they really came on the scene, being one of those vendors that is not afraid of pushing interesting and perhaps sometimes arguably controversial ideas. But this was a piece, and it was, I'm curious what made you share this one and want to talk about it, which is basically saying that pre-sales should own the relationship between the sales team and the product team. And the kind of the summary, right, and the jumping off, is that we need to own that. Pre-sales solutions, call it what you will, needs to own that relationship because no one else is fully qualified or equipped to kind of address that misalignment. Now, I have an opinion on this, but I'm curious to hear yours first.
Yeah. So when I first read this article, like genuinely, the first thought, like uncensored, that came through my head was, really? Like yet another thing? Like for folks that are familiar with my DemoFest session in 2023, I think it was, in London, like I had this big slide with like a pre-sales person staring at like a wall of masks as like all of the responsibilities of pre-sales people kept on popping in and more and more and more, and we need to do it this and that and the other thing and marketing and sales and, you know, all those bits and pieces. And the overwhelming feedback I get from like pre-sales teams that I work with nowadays is like, yeah, we have so much stuff to do already because of the sheer volume of work coming their way and the more importance that businesses are starting to put into pre-sales as they are realizing that, yes, like actually having a person that can talk to customers about the product in a lot of depth is actually quite, you know, in the current landscape of buyers, like where they do so much of the research already ahead of time, this key person that is coming in at that phase of the process, is like, it's really important for them to have the ability to actually be there and not have a 2-week lead time to actually get the person in front of customers. Is genuinely like, why are we adding even more responsibilities onto the pre-sales team? And that was like it was just like this clutching feeling in my heart of like, you know, what are we doing? Are we asking more of them? And that was really like the topic I wanted to bring into you today, which is like, whilst yes, and it's quite a blunt post as well. There are some things in there around bluntly, like, and I'm quoting here, like bluntly by comparison, most salespeople don't know the product and most product teams cannot sell. And it's like, ooh. Whoa, okay, that's a big statement there. Which, first of all, again, I wouldn't phrase it that way because it makes, like, it already, like, deepens that chasm that we have between salespeople, pre-sales, and product team. But also, like, and I get where they're coming from to try to, like, highlight this problem more and more. But genuinely, like, do you, like, as a first run through this, do you genuinely believe that this is yet another responsibility that has to land on pre-sales' shoulders?
So, I think that pre-sales absolutely should have a key role to play in the relationship with product. And when I kind of talk about like the role of pre-sales, I for a number of years, I've talked about it being the kind of the central point of the business, in that we are the group who touches the most part. We touch business development, sales, marketing, obviously our own world, but we also have post sales. We also get engaged with customer success. And it's not that these other departments don't talk to each other, but in my experience, we have been the department that is the most engaged. And I have gone to length in my own role and with my own companies that I've been in to establish a really tight-knit relationship with product managers, because there's absolutely value, right, for a product manager. And again, interestingly enough, a number of product managers and quite senior product leaders that I've worked with in my career have come from a pre-sales background at some point, or have done pre-sales at some point in their career, and product is absolutely a potential part. And I think that's because it's not just about technically what does it do, but it's about understanding the relationship between what the customer need, the problem they're trying to solve, and how the product can enable them to solve that. And I think that's where that's the role we can play. Now, I bluntly disagree with the statement most salespeople don't know the product, because you cannot in today's climate be an effective B2B salesperson if you don't know your product. Now, you may not be able to demonstrate it to the level that your solutions engineer can, but you do still need to be able to articulate what it does and why it's important and why someone should even talk to you. So I think I understand it's an intentionally provocative statement, but I think it's also kind of quite dangerous to be kind of coming out and go, well, salespeople don't know the product, because you're actually sort of like dismissing a whole group of people that, yes, okay, they don't technically, they're not doing in the product, they're not doing configuration, they're not doing demonstrations primarily. Sometimes they are, but they do still understand the product market fit, and they need to understand product market fit. And I think, again, saying most product teams cannot sell, it's not that they can't sell, it's that they are not typically expected to articulate what the product does in a way that is designed to sell the benefits of it. They are there to say, here is the function and the capability of what it does, rather than here's why you should make an investment. As to whether we should own it, I struggle.
What does owning mean?
Right. Yeah,
what does owning mean in this? Because for me, like when you say like to own a relationship, that means that there is some sort of metrics assigned with that, or like as part of your role description, that is your responsibility. Right, which I think it's quite a serious thing to have as a looming thing, you know, for you as a pre-sales. Because again, I'm imagining myself like back in my field pre-sales days. It's like if I had a term in my contract that says like, oh yeah, by the way, and you are solely responsible to make sure that like the salespeople and the product team know what the heck is happening. It's like, okay, so since when did I become a people manager? Right. So it's a very,
yeah,
like this word ownership. It's quite a, like we throw it around quite a lot, especially within our space. And it's always a little bit concerning because like whilst like, for example, like to give a bit of the example, I am more than happy to say like pre-sales should own the customer relationship alongside, mm-hmm, with the sales/account manager. Mm-hmm. That is a given, because that should be something that you're measured on as a pre-sales person, because you're, again, to the point, like, what is the purpose of pre-sales? Is to have that relationship with the customer, the technical relationship with the customer, the understanding of the customer needs from a completely different perspective and a depth and a level of depth that should not be expected from the salespeople, mm-hmm, because they have other responsibilities, which, you know, predominantly speaking, actually hitting a number, yeah, because somebody has to.
Agreed. And I think you've nailed it with why should it be owned by, because also ownership, I think the other problem that kind of wording uses is it reinforces a silo. It goes, that's your job.
Yes.
Not my job.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's such a dangerous thing to have in a such a team sport as actually selling software. Yeah. And it is breathtaking to actually, and again, to your point, yes, it's provocative on purpose, but it's genuinely breathtaking when like people like you and I just talk about this so much, about like we need to like bridge that gap between technical sales, aka pre-sales, actual sales, product management. It's like that needs to be one cohesive work unit to actually, that's the only way genuinely to be incredibly successful in this world. And yet we have things like that of like, you know, oh no, actually it's solely like it should be solely your responsibility as a pre-sales person to make sure that these people are in check. And it's like, oh, awful. Even that terminology makes me uncomfortable.
Right, and I think that, again, to be fair, right, adding the context that it's kind of coming across with this argument that in the current climate, functions need to justify their existence more, and if you're taking ownership of a relationship with another department, you're going, hey, look, here's the thing that I'm doing that's going to help work on the business and help grow. And whilst I see that, I think it's a little bit of a misnomer to say pre-sales should own it, because actually, yep, surely everybody should be, you know, everyone should have an investment in that, and everyone wants to be working on growing the business, because bluntly, the business grows, everyone makes more money. That's what happens, yep, in sales. You sell more, you make more money. That's kind of why we do it. And you don't have to sort of take a formal ownership of that relationship to, I think as well, as saying you take ownership, it formalizes it. And it's like, oh no, I own it. And you create a space for conflict. If suddenly you find your account manager has gone to product, you go, no, hang on, I own that relationship. You don't. Why are you talking? Where in fact, you should be going,
exactly.
Great. I love it. You're talking to product.
Cause these guys are talking. Yeah.
You're going to give them a different perspective to me. We just saw in our last conversation, we're talking about the cloud and the differences between like SaaS and IIS. And people come with, even in the same, from the same kind of background, you come with very different perspectives. You're going to give differing feedback. And I can tell you now, product managers love getting feedback. If it's constructive, don't just go and tell them, yes. This sucks, right? Go along with the solution. But if you go to them for... find out who the product manager is for your region, whoever it is. If you say to them, look, can I grab 30 minutes? Because we were in a demo or a presentation and this question came up, or this regulation came up, or this requirement came up. I'd not come across it before. Is that something we're thinking about? They're going to love you because they're going to go, we didn't know about that, because they're heads down writing functional spec documents trying to manage the roadmap. So I guess my thing is absolutely take ownership of your relationship with product. Don't wait for someone else to tell you to do it. But I don't think that we should be saying pre-sales now owns this relationship, because I think that...
I think you nailed it right there. Like, take your ownership of your relationship. Don't take ownership of the relationship, right? Because there is a common relationship and a common sort of not only communication channel, but responsibilities between all of the three parties. But it's mostly you as an individual, for you to be conscious of that communication channel between yourself, the salesperson and the product team. But it's not about not sort of capitalizing, but not hoarding that mm-hmm. relationship. Like, that's the word that comes to mind. Like, you know, you're not hoarding it. And I think that, again, that's a really important distinction there, where it's about, if you keep in mind what the ultimate goal is, and this is always the problem of putting something in writing, which is like, if your goal is to own this, you're going to, if you want to be successful, you own the heck out of it to a potentially negative degree. Mm. But if you just say that this is an important part of your role and you need to be conscious of it and you need to be considerate of it, yes, absolutely. But yet again, back to the whole, to the main point of it, should this be yet another word that comes on that slide that I have of the 20 different responsibilities that a pre-sales person has officially, alongside with working alongside marketing, with pushing content out there, with doing demo automation, with doing this, with doing that, with learning new things, with, you know, again, customer relationship, which we, you know, you and I both agree should be something that pre-sales people do actually own. And suddenly you have yet another thing, which is technically a people manager. Mm. Where do you fit that in the, if you imagine the day-to-day of a pre-sales person, where do you put that practically?
Mm. Yeah.
in what slot in the calendar do you put that in?
Right. And I think as well, and I'm kind of just going through the article again, It does talk more about pre-sales leaders, and I think as a pre-sales leader myself, I would say I would encourage you even more to encourage your teams to engage a product, and maybe that's where you need to take ownership. If you don't currently have a regular meeting with your product, take ownership of that and set it up, right? Work with your management and your counterparts and their counterparts and go, I want to do this, and this is the objective. And be clear in your objectives, right, what it is. And you kind of then end up, you can, again, to the point of the article, right, which is being able to justify and demonstrate the impact you're having on the business. You can still do that, but you can do it in a way that is more collaborative. And I think that's what we're pushing, right? It's this idea of it should be a collaborative effort. It should not be a responsibility that you feel you need to take to justify what you're doing. It's a, I'm doing this because I want to benefit, for the benefit of everybody, and to have that. Again, because from a product perspective, and having done a little bit of that at one point, it's great to get feedback. And again, reach out to your product managers, talk to them, but ask them, how do you want me to give you this information? Because then they might say, this is a great forum. They might say, email this inbox. They might say, we have a system, Jira, and work out what that is. And bear in mind, if you're giving them something, they will be a lot more likely to be in a place of willing to help you when you go to AI therapy. Lydia, are you at all familiar? So this is in a particular context of something for me. So as you know, I am a person who likes to do what some might call stupid, pointless challenges for the sake of doing. Things like triathlons, ultramarathons, that kind of stuff. Just over 10 years ago, I had an injury and I was off work for about 3 weeks. And I came across a thing called NaNoWriMo, or National Novel Writing Month, which is the month of November, and the idea is that you write 50,000 words of a novel in 30 days. Not it doesn't have to be crafted. The point of it is that you just every day you sit and write something, part of it, and at the end of it you've either got something you can use or you've got something you just and I think for me at the time I probably still have what I wrote somewhere. And it was just a chance to, like, expunge this idea I'd been working on and mulling around for a while. And I kind of always think, hey, I'd quite like to do that again. But I haven't gone back to it. But that's the context. That's what NaNoWriMo is. It's all about you as a person writing. Now, this last week, there's a piece. I came across it in Wired. It was actually a statement that the people who run NaNoWriMo put out, which is that, and I'm just going to quote this. They said, the categorical condemnation of artificial intelligence in support of the challenge has classist and ableist undertone.
Hold on, hold the horses. So people are using tools like ChatGPT, Claude, for writing the challenge.
The non-profit that runs the challenge, runs the website, runs the community, basically came out and said, you can't condemn people for using AI.
You cannot condemn people.
You cannot. They kind of came out in saying, oh, we support people using AI. And
right.
It's a bit like, everyone's a bit like, what? Why? Where did this come from?
Yeah, no, I'm having the exact same reaction at the moment as well. Because, so, just to, let me relay back to you what I think the purpose of this is. Because I am aware of this challenge. I haven't done it myself, but I'm aware of it. Writing out your thoughts in a, you know, be it to write towards a novel or towards anything, really. There is something that our human brains really benefit from, to put our floating thoughts that are running through our heads into a written format. It is it has been proven time and time again. You know, that's why journaling is such a huge thing. That's why, like, just, you know, jotting down your thoughts, it's like whenever you're doing any sort of like deep thinking about topics of your life or any topics really, it's incredibly beneficial for you as a human to do that. I am really struggling here to understand the concept of where you have no reward, no financial, you know, again, there's no prize at the end of this. This is purely for you as a person to be able to sort of say to yourself, like, yeah, I can write this huge amount, like, I can put in this huge amount of effort into a written format to either, again, work towards a finished piece of work or just to, like, explore my own thoughts and, you know, opinions. And yet, the non-profit that is hosting this is saying, like, oh yeah, no, actually, we're cool with AI. Mm-hmm. Which is, like, first of all, a strange thing to say anyway, because why do you care?
Yeah.
Is there any rules in place? Like, so, sorry, because I haven't...
There's no rules. And the thing is, it gets better, right? Because they put this post up on, not on their blog, but on their Zendesk page. So, like, the support page.
Yeah.
And it's going to, so again, the full quote, the opening line. NaNoWriMo does not explicitly support any specific approach to writing, nor does it explicitly condemn any approach, including the use of AI. They have since, this was first published, added a note which I hadn't actually seen, which is, note, we have edited this post by adding a paragraph to reflect our acknowledgement that there are bad actors in the AI space who are doing harm to writers and who are acting unethically. This comes in the same week in which OpenAI have basically said, we have to use copyrighted content to train our models because the free content is not good enough. It's just like, why?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of things there that okay. That is such a, okay. It is very strange to have a non-profit that would, obviously, like, as far as I understand, the mission is to get people writing, which, again,
yes,
we can all agree, very positive thing for the individual, like, mentality, that, you know, for them, for, you know, it's an overall, I think we can all agree, overall fantastic thing to write more in your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a mandatory thing, you can have other, you know, but again, as far as the challenge go, this is a very positive one. Right? Because, again, there is no competition, as far as I know, there is no winners in this. Like, it's not a competition about, like, who has the best written thing. I fail to understand. And yes, I can understand, like, the initial statement, which is, like, we don't encourage any one specific type of writing. There is no right way, which I completely agree with. Like, if you like outlines, that's great. If you want, like, just, you know, stream of consciousness coming out of your fingers and onto your keyboard, that's also great. Like, I get that part.
Mm-hmm.
But when AI comes in, and when, like, to your point about, like, And we've known this, right? Like, we've known that, like, tools like ChatGPT and OpenAI, like, as a company, they are, it's an incredibly controversial topic for this reason, because, yes, they are gaining money. They're literally getting a subscription payment from using other people's work for free.
Mm-hmm.
And Apple was, like, at the moment, because obviously, like, I follow quite a lot of Apple news, like, Apple are under a lot of fire because of this, because they sort of like volunteered everyone to jump into like to feed their own engine, and now they're sort of like taking a step back and going like, oh, but you can opt out now. It is like, well, too little too late, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You can already use the data. And yet something that should be a non-profit that is supporting people's ability to write more, to make such a strange announcement, which, by the way, I can imagine most likely they were just inundated with questions, which is, you know, makes sense for them to put it in the support page, and they were just trying to, or potentially like someone in the team there had a bright idea of like, oh, let's preemptively sort of make a statement on this so people don't bother us about it, and thus it exploded.
It is the most like it's the most centralist Paul's one Futurama reference per episode. It's the most, like, there's the whole thing about the neutral people on the neutral planet, and it's a beige alert, and it's just like, it's the most beige statement ever, because they kind of make it worse by essentially implying that what they don't want to do is condemn people using it for things like checking grammar, checking structure, providing feedback, and again, absolutely fine, and it's fair.
Sort
of couched in this way of just sort of trying to not upset anybody, but at the same time, I'm a bit like
upsetting everybody.
you've upset everyone. You tried to not upset anyone, but by doing so, you've upset everyone. And I'm still not really clear on your point. If your point is, we don't want to say don't use AI, fine, right? But I feel like it's such a personal value judgment to make as well, right? If you personally choose to use an AI large language model to help you in this process, that is your prerogative. And again, as you've said, if you use it to write for you, then what is the point of the challenge? It's the equivalent of getting in the car at the start of a marathon to then get out of the last mile. You haven't achieved anything, right? You've just the only person you've cheated is yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And that's like, again, that's my biggest thing. If I was to if you were to put me in charge of like the like PR manager of this non-profit, I would turn around and go, like, just as a reminder, what is the purpose? What is the value that people are getting? Like, I'll just inject some pre-sales into there. Like, remind people of what the value of this challenge is. It's not about completing it and having, like a check mark and saying, like, yeah, I did it. It is about challenging yourself and doing the thing that is going to be hard and not the thing that is going to be easy. How you do it is your own prerogative, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they should have, they need to explicitly state that, because, yeah, as you said, like, for example, non-native English speaker here, like, yeah, I would use like these tools like Grammarly to fix up my spelling and grammar. Of course, like that's a well-known use case for these type of, you know, like logic engines. It's a use case that people have been doing for a very long time. There's nothing controversial about that. Mm. If you want to do outlines with the help of these tools, sure, right? If you need some brainstorming because you don't have someone to talk through your ideas, also, I would say fair. But again, what are you trying to achieve here? Is it just to get the words out? Because if it is just to get the words out, and again, back to my point, we're trying to position value here. If you are trying to achieve writing words in place and you're really stuck with ideas, sure, use whatever tool you have in place. If you just want to have like the challenge of actually pushing your brain to that limit of actually getting the writing out there without any assistance, don't use them. Right? Mm-hmm. If you want to improve your grammar and spelling, sure, also don't use Grammarly. That's completely up to you.
Thanks for listening. We hope that you enjoyed this new format. We're going to keep playing with it. And as we mentioned last time, we do have some more changes coming. Please let us know what you think. If you want the episodes to be shorter, if you want them to be longer, whatever you feel. And also, if you have any topics that you'd like to hear me and Lydia talk about, if you think there's something that may trigger a rant from one or both of us, please send it over to us on either LinkedIn or drop a comment on one of the posts. We'd love to hear from you. It's great that you're listening. And please do give us a rating and review on your podcast player of choice.
Thank you so much for listening.